dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, Free Radio Olympia 91.3, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KFAR Knoxville, streaming on the web, and welcome listeners to KRFP, Moscow, Idaho's new low-power FM station at 92.5. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. What is at stake in the coming election goes far beyond the choice of one candidate over another. In the words of journalist Catherine Eureka, Americans and the mainstream media have been very slow in catching on to the fact that we are in a war that is cultural, religious, and political, a war that uses stealth and deception and the rules of engagement written by the enemies to representative democracy. Unless Americans wake up, we could lose that war. Close quote. Eureka is not referring to international terrorists, but to Christian fascists known as Dominionists or the New Traditional Movement. Their aim, the establishment of a theocratic corporate state. Is this an obscure group in the backwoods? Not hardly. Their decision-making body is a secretive group called the Council for National Policy, and some of its members include familiar names such as Grover Norquist, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, Pat Robertson, Nelson Bunker Hunt, Phyllis Schlafly, Jack Kemp, Alan Keyes, Joseph Coors, Major General John K. Singlaub, Edwin Meese, Senator William Dannemeyer, Senator Jesse Helms, and Paul Weyrich, who is also the founder of the Free Congress Foundation, which has issued a strategic plan on how to gain control of the government of the United States. This plan, often referred to as Weyrich's Training Manual, was written by Eric Heubeck and is titled The Integration of Theory and Practice, a Program for the New Traditionalist Movement. It is taught in leadership classes, along with Hitler's Mein Kampf and William L. Shirer's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Some excerpts from that manual. Quote, this essay is based on the belief that the truth of an idea is not the primary reason for its acceptance. Far more important is the energy and dedication of the idea's promoters, in other words, the individuals composing a social or political movement. There will be three main stages in the unfolding of this movement. The first stage will be devoted to the development of a highly motivated elite able to coordinate future activities. The second stage will be devoted to the development of institutions designed to make an impact on the wider elite and a relatively small minority of the masses. The third stage will involve changing the overall character of American popular culture. We will maintain a constant barrage of criticism against the left. We will attack the very legitimacy of the left. We will not give them a moment's rest. We will endeavor to prove that the left does not deserve to hold sway over the heart and mind of a single American. We must create a countervailing force that is just as adept as the left at intimidating people and institutions that are used as tools of left-wing activism, but are not ideologically committed, such as Hollywood celebrities, multinational corporations, and university administrators. We must be feared, so they will think twice before opening their mouths. Close quote. That from the Integration of Theory and Practice, a Program for the New Traditionalist Movement. This week on the program, we'll explore the imposition of theocracy in America. We begin with Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio, speaking with Reverend Rich Lang of Trinity United Methodist Church in Ballard, Washington, about his article, The Rise of Christian Fascism.
You have written an article entitled George Bush and the Rise of Christian Fascism that was forwarded to me, and I found fascinating, and that's going to be what the bulk of what we're talking about today. I'm wondering if we can begin with you telling us, what do you see as Christian fascism?
Well, the paper began as a talk, and what I was attempting to do is get some clarity about, you know, what's happening to the country. And originally it was written about a year ago. And again, being a pastor, I'm particularly concerned with what's this use of religious rhetoric. And I know that in the course of political history, presidents have used religious rhetoric all the time. I mean, it kind of goes part and parcel. You have to legitimate your policies through some means of transcendence, and usually pulling God into the picture helps anybody that wants to push something on folks. But this administration seemed to be doing it on steroids, so to speak. And so I started thinking about what is the popularity behind Bush? And in particular, I can probably give a quick story. In particular, within my own family structure, with people that I respect and love and care for, people who I think are, you know, reasonably good thinkers, moderate people, sometimes, you know, a little conservative, but not obnoxiously so. But they were loving this guy. They absolutely were loving George Bush. They were loving his rhetoric, his, quote, his moral leadership and so forth. And so I decided to try to give some thinking to that. And what I believe is happening in the country is and it's been happening for quite a while, and I think that 9/11 certainly accelerated this, is that there is a growing linkage of all the spheres of power into one. And, you know, the genius of being of American democracy, the experiment here, is that power is diffused, so that if you have a strong presidency, you know, you might have a balanced Congress. You know, you'll have Democrats and Republicans, and they check each other. And then the judicial will even check them, and the press will check them, and even the church will check them. And business, it has its agenda, and labor and union. Well, I think what we're seeing is the fusion of all of that power under one ideology. And I began to think in terms of fascism. You know, you put nationalism on top of that, and especially after 9/11, there's the scent of racism in the air. But underneath all of that was this religious rhetoric. And so what I'm calling Christian fascism is that I think that there is a growing movement in this country that fuses the right-wing church, and we get into that a little bit more, along with this political movement, this neoconservative political movement, which I think is very anti-democratic in orientation. I think it's very fascist in orientation. And you fuse these two together, and that's what I'm calling Christian fascism. And, of course, I suppose my area of greatest concern is, okay, what's happening to the church and all of that. But I'm also a citizen in this country, and I'm seeing the political results. And you know, I got two sons at home, 15 and age 15 and 11, and I think that generation is going to pay a heavy cost for this particular administration and shift in the American psyche.
So I think our regular listeners would be familiar with the concept of neoconservatives in the White House, outside the White House as well. And we often hear of people talking about the far right and far right Christian movement, but there's never any specifics on it. So can you tell us a bit about what makes up this movement? Are we talking about, for instance, like Pat Robertson? Would he be part of that?
I'll start with an audacious claim, and I say this in my talk. I think the future of this country revolves around who controls the interpretation of Scripture, of what's commonly called the Old Testament and New Testament. And, you know, we're supposedly a secular country, but I think to help people put their minds around it, the voice, the moral voice of rhetoric, of religious rhetoric in this country, I think is either going to go the way of a Pat Robertson or the way of a Martin Luther King. And what I see is that the Robertson wing is on the rise. And what that wing is all about goes something like this. In any scripture, and certainly in the Christian and Judeo scriptures, there are always layers of meaning. And, you know, you can almost find anything you want in there because it's written over a long period of time by different people in different situations. And within the Bible, there are narratives, which I would call holy war narratives. And that is this whole notion that calls forth the righteous warrior to purge evil out of the land. And it's a moral development because, you know, something is happening in society that is frightful and fearful and it's causing chaos and terror and people are dying. And so in reaction to that, religious legitimation is given for violence. And the religious person will, without guilt, without shame, with the kind of conscience that can sleep well at night, will be given permission to purify the land for the good of all. Even the good of the enemy that you're purifying. And that's what I call the holy war narratives that are embedded in some of the scriptures. Those are the narratives that the Bush administration and the religious right wing in this country are really drawing on in a very powerful and in a very new way, I think. And I'll give some examples of that in a minute. The other narrative, the one that Martin Luther King drew on, and I would say Jesus drew on, is what you call the prophetic narrative. Throughout Scripture, there is a storyline that is against empire. It's against the accumulation of power. And the prophetic critique of power, the one that says to the king, we need to limit your ability, that just because you make a decision doesn't mean that that has to be the rule of law, so to speak. And so the prophets arose to critique the exploitative business practices and the overreaching of power by the king, so to speak. And Jesus comes out of that tradition, and he speaks of compassion and mercy and inclusivity and welcoming the sinner, welcoming the unclean, because that's the way to peace, is you create a relational economy and you create a relational politics that reaches out and embraces the concerns of the least among them. Mr. Bush and the Bush administration use Jesus, but then redefine his message through holy war narratives, which Jesus never drew upon. The importance of this is I think that's what's happening. One of the major conflicts in the church throughout this country is which narrative is going to rule the pulpit. And what we're hearing, the media expression of Christianity, is almost entirely this holy war narrative of purity. And it's driven by two branches. One that I think is very familiar to people, especially those who have ever seen these Left Behind books in stores. One is this apocalypticism. And what that means is that's a catastrophic, we're living in catastrophic times. The world is about to come to an end. But there is it's kind of like Freud's Thanatos syndrome. There's actually a desire for the world to come to an end because it's become so impure and things are so chaotic and people are so unrighteous that what needs to happen is a huge purifying of the land. The media expression of Christianity and many evangelical and fundamentalist churches are drawing upon these narratives that we are living in the end times. It's a theology of despair. How that translates, to give a case example, is why bother with the environment? Because we're not going to be around in 100 years. And so it's just not that important to create and build a sustainable society. Another way that translates that I think, again, might be familiar to many folks because it's in the media, and that's this absolute marching in lockstep with the hard right of Israel. There can be no critique of Israeli-Palestinian relationships, and nor is there linkage with the church in America and the church in Palestine. Rather, it's a wedding between the right wing in this country and the right wing in Israel. It doesn't matter what Israel does to the Palestinian people, because in Christian right wing rhetoric, Israel, the scenario they've painted that is for the end times, is that the Jews have to be in their land, They have to be in political control of their land. The temple needs to be rebuilt in their land, which means that, you know, any day now we might see the self-fulfilling prophecy of the mosque on the Dome of the Rock destroyed. Now, that would just electrify the right-wing church. They would think that Jesus is coming back any minute once that happens. And these are practical political implications of a religious worldview that is being pushed amongst, what, close to 40 million Americans that attend these right-wing churches. That Christian apocalypticism is being wedded with another form of theology called dominionism. And in a nutshell, what we can say about that is that's the notion that Christians are elected by God to have dominion over the governments of the world. We are to rule, in other words. Christians are to rule by force, if necessary, for the good of all. And, you know, that's, again, we can talk about that a bit more. That's not only, you know, just political philosophies and economic philosophies, but in particular, that's moral philosophies. And the impure, the immoral, again, get your mind around this, think homosexuals, need to be eradicated for the good of all. And this is right-wing Christian belief in this country, and not only in this country, but around the world. And it's the Christianity that is growing. It's a mirror image of the Taliban, you know, the Islamic fundamentalism. And so, I think what we're seeing across the world in our culture and throughout cultures is a growing crisis of faith. You know, does the world have a future, and what does that future look like?
Is it fair to call it, to lump all the right-wing Christians into this, though? I mean, it seems to me it's more extreme right-wing.
Sure. I mean, because you always start with the elites, and the elites are, you know, you get some, you put money behind, you know, particular people that can voice and articulate an extreme version of this, but then it really does trickle down. And this, you know, for example, lots of folks have Christians in their families, their extended families or friendships, and right-wing Christians, and they might say, well, you know, we've heard a little bit of this, but we really don't believe this. But it begins to trickle down, and what was once extreme becomes commonplace. And that's my concern, is that, yeah, this is extreme theology. This is theology on the fringe. But, you know, I've been watching this for 20 years, and that fringe theology is now mainstream theology. Christian apocalypticism has been around for over, you know, well over 100 years, but it's been in the last decade, maybe the last couple decades, maybe with Reagan in the 80s, you began to see that it made a big move into the mainstream. Apocalyptic Christianity is mainstream Christianity. I mean, there's probably 40 million Americans that, or more, that think Jesus is coming back tomorrow, and that the scriptures are a script, and, you know, it ends with total and complete destruction of this planet, and then, you know, King Jesus comes back and recreates something. So I think that even though some of this rhetoric is extreme, it filters into the main line. Let me give a political example. Scalia, the Supreme Court justice, is a prototype of what this administration likes in a federal judge. And Bush has said that himself. You know, if he's going to appoint Supreme Court justices, he wants to support people like Scalia. Scalia, give a quote. He says that government derives its moral authority from God. Government is the minister of God with powers to revenge, to execute wrath, including wrath by the sword. Scalia is drawing from a passage in Romans chapter 13. And again, I think in my point of view would be taking it out of context, but he draws his political philosophy and legitimates his political philosophy through an appeal to a very rigid interpretation of Scripture. And if you look at Romans 13, which Scalia is citing here, where you eventually get to the point of is that all dissent, any dissent, is a form of treason. And any resistance to the good government ordained by God should be prohibited. And Scalia goes on to say that when he looks at the Constitution, again, quote, a direct quote from him, the Constitution that I interpret and apply is not living, but dead. This is kind of how right-wing Christians read the Scripture. The Bible isn't living. There's no real active dialogue in it. The Scripture that was written 2,000 years ago means today exactly what it meant back then. And so all this grid of interpretation and applying it to society is irrelevant. And so Scalia, the code word here that federal judges like him use, is they want to apply the Constitution in its original intent. Well, again, what that would mean in terms of an original intent is if you go back to the 1700s when the Constitution was written, the death penalty at that time clearly permitted a lot of different forms of death for different kinds of felonies. So much so that if you look back in the law, if horse thievery was a felony, and therefore a person who stole the horse could be killed, well, the original intent of that, well, today if people steal horses, you know, they can be killed. It just takes another step to say there's a precedent for all kinds of felonies, including dissent, accusing someone of witchcraft, accusing someone of adultery or homosexuality or heresy or so forth. As long as you could find a law in 1791 that made those acts a felony, you could say that this implies that it's okay to have a death penalty. In and of itself, that's crazy talk. That doesn't mean much. But what we're seeing in our time is that the growing strength of government, either through the imperial presidency or a Congress or the judicial branch, of having a tighter and tighter stranglehold around the civil rights of the American people. And so I think, although this is extreme rhetoric, I think over time it begins to filter down, and what was once crazy then becomes permissible.
I was checking out Catherine Eureka's website. She writes a lot on the subject, and I was curious if you agreed with this interpretation that the current administration in the White House, in line with the extreme right, believes that the American poor and middle class are beneath them and have earned God's wrath by their lasciviousness and undisciplined lives. That was her quote. Have you read that, and do you agree with that?
You know, I do agree. I think that I agree that within Christian rhetoric and my intuition of this particular administration and the mood of many in the country, and that's what I'm more concerned about, is the character of the American people, is that poverty, those who are poor are blamed for their poverty, that it's somehow their fault that they can't get out of poverty. And again, I think that people are, the American people can still be compassionate, and they're willing to offer a hand up, but it's almost as if we look at the poor without the context of how this poverty arises, and we simply think that, okay, we give somebody $100 or we give them a month's rent so they can get on their feet, they'll be on their feet. But if there are no jobs to get on your feet with, and if the jobs that you have are constantly squashing you, again, the lack of meaningful work, the lack of calling out a person's creativity and imagination, the system itself becomes very oppressive. People don't get ahead. They don't see a future for themselves. Again, to get our minds around this, I don't know how anyone can be living in Seattle making less than $50,000 a year. I mean, it's just extremely difficult to live in Seattle for underneath that. And yet, you know, last night I went to a restaurant, and I can tell you that the waitress is not making $50,000 a year. As a matter of fact, she's working two jobs, you know, because we asked her. She works during the day at one restaurant, and she worked at this particular restaurant at nights doing banquet service. You know, had I been able to totally interview her, you know, and if I had gotten to know her, my real questions were, you know, how do you have a life? You know, where is your Sabbath break? Where is your ability to, you know, rejoice in the fruits of your labor? And what I see over and over in the lives of the working class, the working poor, and certainly the homeless, is that there is a lack of a future, and poverty becomes spiritually very demoralizing. I think that factor is overlooked quite often, and that people, even Christians, seem to think sometimes that getting out of poverty is simply a technique. You know, give them a job at McDonald's and somebody will work themselves out of poverty. And I think it really overlooks the systemic structures of the kind of economy we've created and what it's done to us.
What I found interesting from that section, if it is true that they hold the poor and the middle class beneath them and that those need to be purged, is if you take that in combination with the strategy coming out of some of the groups that are leading this extreme wing, like, for instance, one of the documents from, is it the Free Congress organization, the document, The Integration of Theory and Practice, a Program for a New Traditionalist Movement, where they talk about destroying the infrastructure that we currently have in this country so that they can rebuild it in their own image. So they're talking about that these people are beneath them, yet they are going to destroy the infrastructure that allows these people to survive. So they're essentially creating these people in a way.
Right. But again, in terms of holy war rhetoric, you know, it's tough love. You need to purge the impure and the evil of society for the good of all, so that we can rebuild society, reconstruct society. Dominion theology is called reconstructionism. So you can reconstruct society. And when you reconstruct society, you know, according to the theory, their theories, is that the poor will actually be given a new start, you know, in a sense. And because their moral character will be such that they won't fall into poverty again. It's very utopian kind of thinking. But in many senses, and I perhaps being a little too harsh here, but in many senses, the poor simply don't matter, because God will bless you if you're righteous. And so if you're poor, there's obviously something in your life that has kept you from receiving the blessings of God. And that needs to be corrected. And your eternal soul is far more important than your physical body. And so if your physical body needs to be exterminated, well, you know, at least your soul can be saved.
Only have about 5 minutes left. So clarify for me, how do these people synchronize what they're doing with the teachings of Jesus? I mean, if Jesus is teaching that, you know, you're supposed to be good to others and...
Well, you'll notice, or you could if you study them, they won't talk about the Sermon on the Mount very much. Matter of fact, they reinterpret the Sermon on the Mount to mean, but to get them off the hook a little bit, I think the vast majority of Christians have reinterpreted the Sermon on the Mount, saying that it was an idealistic ethic and Jesus didn't mean what he said. I personally disagree with that. I think Jesus meant exactly what he said. But the kind of the Dominion branch, and again, the extreme right wing, I think continually what we need to keep in mind is that they believe that if our personal character conveys a certain holiness, that, you know, and they have a little definition for that, God will bless us. And if the blessing is not there, if something is happening in our family structures, in our personal relationships, in our own prayer life that is causing some dissonance between ourselves and God, that's our fault, and there's obviously some sin, some kind of wickedness in us that needs to be purged out of us. And I think that needs to be kept in mind in dealing with the right-wing church, is it's very much a holiness movement, and very much a literal black and white world. You are pure or you're impure. You're moving one direction or the other.
For those people that aren't religious at all, that sit back and hear about the extreme right and then perhaps look at yourself and would just paint you, well, you're one of the extreme left Christians, or, you know, and you're all a bunch of nuts, and why should I worry about this anyway? Because you're a minority group out there. You're, you know, you talk loud, but you're really not affecting things.
I would disagree. I just disagree. I think that Christian rhetoric in this particular culture and this particular country is very much, I mean, leave aside the truth claims. Is it true or is it not? But simply the Christian rhetoric is behind any politician. They all need, all political movements need some form of sacred transcendence to legitimate their movement. And in this country, that has to come through Christian rhetoric. And I think that's why secular folks who have no connection with the church and other folks outside of the Christian religion really do need to pay attention to what's happening in the church. And in that sense, I would draw, it's a strained analogy, but I would draw the analogy with Germany and the rise of Hitler and Nazism, which I do equate with this administration and what's happening in our country. But, you know, Hitler also drew upon narratives in scripture to legitimate his drive towards power. And of course, you know, once he, you know, kind of consolidated that power, that rhetoric got deep-sixed a little bit. But the, you know, another way to look at the history of World War II or the history of the rise of Nazism is to study the church history that was happening and the compromises and how the church reacted to the whole Nazi drive towards power. I do think there's some parallels, and I think the church is worth paying attention to from a strictly secular point of view.
All right. What are some resources people can turn to if they want to find out more about this?
The paper, the talk I give, George Bush and the Rise of Christian Fascism, is on our church's website, and so people can turn to that, because at the end of that paper is some resources, and that would be tumseattle.org, tumseattle.org, and... you know, I'm just looking down and realizing I don't have Catherine Eureka, but if you have...
Oh,
you have,
hers is you can go to her website. It's the Eureka Report, Eureica Report.com.
She's my hero these days. I think she is doing incredible research. There's another one called Theocracy Watch. It's either .org or .com. But Theocracy Watch is another one.
We've just been talking with Reverend Rich Lang. He is pastor at Trinity United Methodist Church in Ballard.
And the interviewer was Mike McCormick. The teaching of evolution in public school science classes has again become a battleground. Next, I'm going to read you an article titled "The Crusade Against Evolution. In the Beginning There Was Darwin, and Then There Was Intelligent Design. How the next generation of, quote, creation science is invading America's classrooms." An article by Evan Ratliff, the cover story of the October issue of Wired magazine. And Ratliff writes, "On a spring day 2 years ago, in a downtown Columbus auditorium, the Ohio State Board of Education took up the question of how to teach the theory of evolution in public schools. A panel of four experts, two who believe in evolution, two who question it, debated whether an anti-evolution theory known as intelligent design, ID, should be allowed into the classroom. This is an issue, of course, that was supposed to have been settled long ago. But 140 years after Darwin published On the Origin of Species, 75 years after John Scopes taught natural selection to a biology class in Tennessee, and 15 years after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against a Louisiana law mandating equal time for creationism, the question of how to teach the theory of evolution was being reopened here in Ohio. The two-hour forum drew chanting protesters and a police escort for school board members. Two scientists, biologist Ken Miller from Brown University and physicist Lawrence Krauss from Case Western Reserve University, 2 hours north in Cleveland, defended evolution. On the other side of the dais were two representatives from the Discovery Institute in Seattle, the main sponsor and promoter of intelligent design. Stephen Meyer, a professor at Palm Beach Atlantic University's School of Ministry and director of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, and Jonathan Wells, a biologist, Discovery Fellow, and author of Icons of Evolution, a 2000 book castigating textbook treatments of evolution. Krauss and Miller methodically presented their case against ID. By no definition of any modern scientist is intelligent design science, Krauss concluded, and it's a waste of our students' time to subject them to it, close quote. Meyer and Wells took the typical intelligent design line. Biological life contains elements so complex, the mammalian blood clotting mechanism, the bacterial flagellum, that they cannot be explained by natural selection. And so, the theory goes, we must be products of an intelligent designer. Creationists call that creator God, but proponents of intelligent design studiously avoid the G word and never point to the Bible for answers. Instead, ID believers speak the language of science to argue that Darwinian evolution is crumbling. The debate's two-on-two format, with its appearance of equal sides, played right into the ID strategy. To create the impression that this is a very complicated issue that could be seen from two entirely rational yet opposing views. This is a controversial subject, Meyer told the audience. When two groups of experts disagree about a controversial subject that intersects with a public school science curriculum, students should be permitted to learn about both perspectives. We call this the Teach the Controversy approach. Since the debate, Teach the Controversy has become the rallying cry of the National Intelligent Design Movement, and Ohio has become the leading battleground. Several months after the debate, the Ohio School Board voted to change state science standards mandating that biology teachers, quote, critically analyze, quote, evolutionary theory. This fall, teachers will adjust their lesson plans and begin doing just that. In some cases, that means introducing the basic tenets of intelligent design. One of the state's sample lessons looks as though it were lifted from an ID textbook. It's the biggest victory so far for the Discovery Institute. Our opponents would say that these are a bunch of know-nothing people on a state board, says Meyer. We think it shows that our Darwinist colleagues have a real problem now. Close quote. But scientists aren't buying it. What Meyer calls biology for the information age, they call creationism in a lab coat. ID's core scientific principles, laid out in the mid-1990s by a biochemist and a mathematician, have been thoroughly dismissed on the grounds that Darwin's theories can account for complexity, that ID relies on misunderstandings of evolution and flimsy probability calculations, and that it proposes no testable explanations. As the Ohio debate revealed, however, the Discovery Institute doesn't need the favor of the scientific establishment to prevail in the public arena. Over the past decade, Discovery has gained grounds in schools, op-ed pages, talk radio, and congressional resolutions as a, quote, legitimate alternative to evolution. ID is playing a central role in biology curricula and textbook controversies around the country. The Institute and its supporters have taken the Teach the Controversy message to Alabama, Arizona, Minnesota, Missouri, Montana, New Mexico, and Texas. The ID movement's rhetorical strategy, better to appear scientific than holy, has turned the evolution debate upside down. ID proponents, quote, Darwin, cite the Scopes monkey trial, talk of scientific objectivity, then in the same breath declare that extraterrestrials might have designed life on Earth. It may seem counterintuitive, but the strategy is meticulously premeditated and it's working as planned. The debate over Darwin is back and coming to a 10th grade biology class near you. At its heart, intelligent design is a revival of an argument made by British philosopher William Paley in 1802. In Natural Theology, the Anglican archdeacon suggested that the complexity of biological structures defied any explanation but a designer, God. Paley imagined finding a stone and a watch in a field. The watch, unlike the stone, appears to have been purposely assembled and wouldn't function without its precise combination of parts. The inference, he wrote, is inevitable that the watch must have a maker. The same logic, he concluded, applied to biological structures like the vertebrate eye. Its complexity implied design. 50 years later, Darwin directly answered Paley's argument to complexity. Evolution by natural selection, he argued in Origin of Species, could create the appearance of design. Darwin, and 100-plus years of evolutionary science after him, seemed to knock Paley into the dustbin of history. In the American public arena, Paley's design argument has long been supplanted by biblical creationism. In the 1970s and 1980s, that movement recast the Bible version in the language of scientific inquiry as creation science, and won legislative victories requiring, quote, equal time in some states. That is, until 1987, when the Supreme Court struck down Louisiana's law. Because creation science relies on biblical texts, the court reasoned it lacked a clear secular purpose and violated the First Amendment clause prohibiting the establishment of religion. Since then, evolution has been the law of the land in U.S. schools, if not always the local choice. Paley reemerged in the mid-1990s, however, when a pair of scientists reconstituted his ideas in an area beyond Darwin's ken, molecular biology. In his 1996 book, Darwin's Black Box, Lehigh University biochemist Michael Behe contended that natural selection can't explain the irreducible complexity of molecular mechanisms like the bacterial flagellum, because its integrated parts offer no selective advantages on their own. 2 years later, in the Design Inference, William Dembski, a philosopher and mathematician at Baylor University, proposed that any biological system exhibiting information that is both complex, highly improbable, and specified, serving a particular function, cannot be a product of chance or natural law. The only remaining option is an intelligent designer, whether God or an alien life force. These ideas became the cornerstones of ID, and Behe proclaimed the evidence for design to be, quote, one of the greatest achievements in the history of science. The scientific rationale behind intelligent design was being developed just as anti-evolution sentiment seemed to be bubbling up. In 1991, UC Berkeley law professor Philip Johnson published Darwin on Trial, an influential anti-evolution book that dispensed with biblical creation accounts while uniting anti-evolutionists under a singular, secular-sounding banner, intelligent design. In subsequent books, Johnson presents not just anti-evolution arguments, but a broader opposition to the philosophy of scientific materialism, the assumption known to scientists as methodological materialism, that all events have material rather than supernatural explanations. To defeat it, he offers a strategy that would be familiar in the divisive world of politics called the wedge. Like a wedge inserted into a tree trunk, cracks in Darwinian theory can be used to split the trunk, eventually overturning scientific materialism itself. That's where discovery comes in. The Institute was founded as a conservative think tank in 1990 by longtime friends and former Harvard roommates Bruce Chapman, director of the Census Bureau during the Reagan administration, and techno-futurist author George Gilder. The Institute is futurist and rebellious, and it's prophetic, says Gilder. It has a science and technology orientation in a contrarian spirit. In 1994, Discovery added ID to its list of contrarian causes, which included everything from transportation to bioethics. Chapman hired Meyer, who studied origin of life issues at Cambridge University, and the Institute signed Johnson, whom Chapman calls the real godfather of the intelligent design movement, as an advisor, and adopted the wedge. For Discovery, the thin end of the wedge, according to a fundraising document leaked on the web in 1999, is the scientific work of Johnson, Behe, Dembski, and others. The next step involves publicity and opinion making. The final goals, a direct confrontation with the advocates of material science, and possible legal assistance in response to integration of design theory into public school science curricula. Close quote. Step one has made almost no headway with evolutionists, the near universal majority of scientists with an opinion on the matter. But that, say Discovery's critics, is not the goal. Ultimately, they have an evangelical Christian message that they want to push, says Michael Ruse, a philosopher of science at Florida State. Intelligent design is the hook. It's a lot easier to skip straight to steps 2 and 3 and sound scientific in a public forum than to deal with the rigor of the scientific community. It starts with education, Johnson told me, referring to his high school curricula. That's where the public can have a voice. The universities and the scientific world do not recognize freedom of expression on this issue. Close quote. Meanwhile, like any champion of a heretical scientific idea, ID supporters see themselves as renegades storming the gates of orthodoxy. We all have a deep sense of indignation, says Meyer, that the wool is being pulled over the public's eyes. The buzz phrase most often heard in the Institute's offices is academic freedom. My hackles go up on the academic freedom issue, Chapman says. You should be allowed in the science to ask questions and posit alternative theories. None of this impresses the majority of the science world. They have not been able to convince even a tiny amount of the scientific community, says Ken Miller. They have not been able to win in the marketplace of ideas. And yet the Discovery Institute's appeals to academic freedom create a kind of catch-22. If scientists ignore the ID movement, their silence is offered as further evidence of a conspiracy. If they join in, they risk reinforcing the perception of a battle between equal sides. Most scientists choose to remain silent. Where the scientific community has been at fault, says Krauss, is in assuming that these people are harmless, like flat earthers. They don't realize that they are well organized and that they have a political agenda. Taped to the wall of Eugenie Scott's windowless office at the National Center for Science Education on the outskirts of Oakland, California, is a chart titled Current Flare-Ups. It's a list of places where the teaching of evolution is under attack, from California to Georgia to Rio de Janeiro. As director of the center, which defends evolution in teaching controversies around the country, Scott has watched creationism up close for 30 years. ID, in her view, is the most highly evolved form of creationism to date. They've been enormously effective compared to the more traditional creationists, who have greater numbers and much larger budgets, she says. Scott credits the blueprint laid out by Johnson, who realized that to win in the court of public opinion, ID needed only to cast reasonable doubt on evolution. He said, "Don't get involved in details. Don't get involved in fact claims," says Scott. "Forget about the age of Earth. Forget about the flood. Don't mention the Bible." The goal, she says, is to focus on the big idea that evolution is inadequate. Intelligent design doesn't really explain anything. It says that evolution can't explain things. Everything else is hand-waving. Close quote. The movement's first test of Johnson's strategies began in 1999, when the Kansas Board of Education voted to remove evolution from the state science standards. The decision, backed by traditional creationists, touched off a fiery debate, and the board eventually reversed itself after several anti-evolution members lost re-election bids. ID proponents used the melee as cover to launch their own initiative. A Kansas group called IDNet nearly pushed through its own textbook in a local school district. 2 years later, the Discovery Institute earned its first major political victory when U.S. Senator Rick Santorum, Republican of Pennsylvania, inserted language written by Johnson into the federal No Child Left Behind Act. The clause, eventually cut from the bill and placed in a non-binding report, called for school curricula to, quote, help students understand the full range of scientific views, quote, on topics that may, quote, generate controversy, such as biological evolution, close quote. As the Institute was demonstrating its beltway clout, a pro-ID group called Science Excellence for All Ohioans fueled a brewing local controversy. SEAO, consisting of a few part-time activists, a website, and a mailing list, began agitating to have ID inserted into Ohio's 10th grade biology standards. In the process, they attracted the attention of a few receptive school board members. When the board proposed a two-on-two debate and invited discovery, Meyer and company jumped at the opportunity. Meyer, whom Glider calls the Institute's resident polymath, came armed with the Santorum Amendment, which he read aloud for the school board. He was bringing a message from Washington, teach the controversy. "We frame the issue quite differently than our supporters," says Meyer. The approach put pro-ID Ohioans on firmer rhetorical ground. Evolution should, of course, be taught, but objectively. Hearing Meyer's suggestion, says Doug Rudy, a software engineer and SEAO's director, we all sat back and said, yeah, that's the way to go. Back in Seattle, around the corner from the Discovery Institute, Meyer offers some peer-reviewed evidence that there is truly a controversy that must be taught. The Darwinists are bluffing, he says, over a plate of oysters at a downtown seafood restaurant. They have the science of the steam engine era, and it's not keeping up with the biology of the information age. Meyer hands me a recent issue of Microbiology and Molecular Biology Reviews with an article by Carl Woese, an eminent microbiologist at the University of Illinois. In it, Woese decries the failure of reductionist biology, the tendency to look at systems merely as a sum of their parts, to keep up with the developments of molecular biology. Meyer says the conclusion of Woese's argument is that the Darwinian emperor has no clothes. It's a page out of the anti-evolution playbook, using evolutionary biology's own literature against it, selectively quoting from the likes of Stephen Jay Gould to illustrate natural selection's downfalls. The Institute marshals journal articles discussing evolution to provide policymakers with evidence of the raging controversy surrounding the issue. Woese scoffs at Meyer's claim when I call him to ask him about the paper. To say that my criticism of Darwinists says that evolutionists have no clothes, Woese says, is like saying that Einstein is criticizing Newton, therefore Newtonian physics is wrong. Debates about evolution's mechanisms, he continues, don't amount to challenges to the theory. And intelligent design, quote, is not science. It makes no predictions and doesn't offer any explanation whatsoever except for God did it, close quote. Of course, Meyer happily acknowledges that Woese is an ardent evolutionist. The Institute doesn't need to impress Woese or his peers. It can simply co-opt the vocabulary of science. Academic freedom, scientific objectivity, teach the controversy, and redirect it to a public trying to reconcile what appear to be two contradictory scientific views. By appealing to a sense of fairness, ID finds a place at the political table, and by merely entering the debate it can claim victory. We don't need to win every argument to be a success, Meyer says. We're trying to validate a discussion that's been long suppressed. This is precisely what happened in Ohio. I'm not a PhD in biology, says board member Michael Cochran, but when I have X number of PhD experts telling me this and X number telling me the opposite, the answer is probably somewhere between the two. An exasperated Krauss claims that a truly representative debate would have had 10,000 pro-evolution scientists against two discovery executives. What these people want is for there to be a debate, says Krauss. People in the audience say, hey, these people sound reasonable. They argue people have different opinions. We should present those opinions in school. That is nonsense. Some people have opinions that the Holocaust never happened, but we don't teach that in history. Eventually, the Ohio Board approved a standard mandating that students learn to describe how scientists continue to investigate and critically analyze aspects of evolutionary theory. Close quote. Proclaiming victory, Johnson barnstormed Ohio churches soon after notifying congregations of a new ID-friendly standard. In response, anxious board members added a clause stating that the standard, quote, does not mandate the teaching or testing of intelligent design, close quote. Both sides claimed victory. A press release from IDNet trumpeted the mere inclusion of the phrase intelligent design, saying that the implication of the statement is that the teaching or testing of intelligent design is permitted. Some pro-evolution scientists, meanwhile, say there's nothing wrong with teaching students how to scrutinize theory. "I don't have a problem with that," says Patricia Princehouse, a professor at Case Western University and an outspoken opponent of ID. "Critical analysis is exactly what scientists do." The good feelings didn't last long. Early this year, a board-appointed committee unveiled sample lessons that laid out the kind of evolution questions students should debate. The models appeared to lift their examples from Wells' book Icons of Evolution. "When I first saw it, I was speechless," says Princehouse. With a Ph.D. in molecular and cell biology from UC Berkeley, Wells has the kind of cred that intelligent design proponents love to cite. But as ID opponents enjoy pointing out, he's also a follower of Sun Myung Moon, and once declared that Moon's prayers convinced me that I should devote my life to destroying Darwinism, close quote. Icons attempts to discredit commonly used examples of evolution, like Darwin's finches and peppered moths. Writing in Nature, evolutionary biologist Jerry Coyne called Icons stealth creationism that strives to debunk Darwinism using the familiar rhetoric of biblical creationists, including scientific quotations out of context, incomplete summaries of research, and muddled arguments, close quote. After months of uproar, the most obvious Icons-inspired lessons were removed, but scientists remain furious. The ones they left in are still arguments for special creation, but you'd have to know the literature to understand what they are saying. They've used so much technical jargon that anybody who doesn't know a whole lot of evolutionary biology looks at it and says, "It sounds scientific to me. What's the matter with it?" says Princehouse. As a friend of mine said, "It takes half a second for a baby to throw up all over your sweater. It takes hours to get it clean." As Ohio teachers prepare their lessons for the coming year, the question must be asked. Why the fuss over an optional lesson plan or two? After all, both sides agree that the new biology standards, in which 10 evolution lessons replace standards that failed to mention evolution at all, are a vast improvement. The answer: in an era when the government is pouring billions into biology, and when stem cells and genetically modified food are front-page news, spending even a small part of the curriculum on bogus criticisms of evolution is arguably more detrimental now than at any time in history. Ironically, says Ohio State University biology professor Steve Rissing, the education debate coincides with Ohio's efforts to lure biotech companies. "How can we do that when our high school biology is failing us?" he says. "Our cornfields are gleaming with GMO corn." There's a fundamental disconnect there. Intelligent design advocates say that teaching students to critically analyze evolution will help give them the skills to, quote, see both sides of all scientific issues. And if the Discovery Institute execs have their way, those skills will be used to reconsider the philosophy of modern science itself, which they blame for everything from divorce to abortion to the insanity defense. "Our culture has been deeply influenced by materialist thought," says Meyer. "We think it's deeply destructive, and we think it's false, and we mean to overturn it." Close quote. It's mid-July, and the Ohio School Board is about to hold its final meeting before classes start this year. There's nothing about intelligent design on the agenda. The debate was settled months ago, and yet Princehouse, Rissing, and two other scientists rise to speak during the non-agenda public testimony portion. One by one, the scientists recite their litany of objections. The model lesson plan is still based on concepts from ID literature. The ACLU is considering suing to stop it. The National Academy of Science opposes it as unscientific.